please rise. Hear ye. All members of Congress having anything to bring before the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. I'm going to speak for 15 minutes and reserve 5 for rebuttal. I will address what appellants believe to be two clear legal errors made by the trial court, which, unless corrected, will adversely affect not only my client's interest in this case, but future appraisal decisions in this state. Our first point is that the court, in selecting a tax rate to be applied to net income or taxable income for a C corporation of 11%, selected a rate that's contrary to law. The United States Federal Tax Code has a low rate, the lowest rate on the first dollar of income, of 15%, and it goes up from there. The lowest state rate, and this was a company operating in New York City, New York State, the lowest state rate on the first dollar of income was 16%. So to select an 11% rate as the tax rate to apply to your taxable income is contrary to law.
When you say that it's contrary to law, am I understanding you correctly to be saying it is not in the tax code?
Yes.
Okay, but the court wasn't determining what the tax code provides, was it? The court was determining what an appraised value ought to be.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But in no case, no appraisal case, using a DCF valuation, has any court in this state that we found, and the plaintiffs have, the appellee has cited none, has a court ever used other than the legal rate. It's not a variable. It's not like a discount rate over which people can argue. It's not like an argument over what expenses should be. It's not like an argument over whether the revenues will be larger or smaller. Here, the court accepted the revenues and the expenses for the 10-year DCF projection period. So it subtracted, as both experts did, the expenses from the revenues, achieved a taxable income. To that, both experts applied a legal tax rate. The plaintiff's expert said, I'm going to assume that there was a conversion to an S status. Under the tax code, the federal tax code, you pay no tax at the federal level. The shareholders pay it. It's like a flow through to a partnership. You pay state taxes, nevertheless, in New York City and New York State. They don't give you credit for being an S corporation. They still tax you, albeit at a slightly lower rate than if you were a C corp. So the plaintiff's expert used an S rate, 11%. Our expert said, this is a C corporation, that's how I'm valuing it. To which the court agreed, this is a C corp valuation model. He used 44%, a combination of the federal rate and the state rate for a C corp. The plaintiff's expert said, had I done a C corp valuation model, I would have used the same rate. The only reason I didn't was I assumed a conversion for my model. But the court said, you can't assume, and we say rightly so. Under C.D., Gonzalez, Aronson, the cases we cite in our brief. Now, the court was obviously trying to reach some shorthand result, but this court said in the CNA case, in every court that's ever used this valuation model, takes the legal rate. There is no support in law or in finance literature. The court will look through the appellee's brief from start to finish find no finance treatise that says that when you get the taxable income, you don't use the statutory tax rate. Where did the 11% come from? The court will also look at the Chancery Court's opinion and not find where it came from. There is no logical process to get to an 11% rate. There is no record support for it, and the court engaged in no process to support it. If the court looks at the appellee's brief, you will see when the court is trying, when the appellee is trying to defend the arbitrary use of the 11% rate, the appellee says on page 19, well, okay, so maybe our expert did concede if you do a C-Corp valuation model, you have to use 44%. But, you know, the court was free to reject both experts and pick its own rate. And the court had credible evidence for that. Doesn't say what it was. But then, if you go back to the Haskell argument, where they're trying to defend the use of a net asset valuation, and they're trying to say, well, you know, the court picked something from this expert and something from that expert. They say what the court did, and this is on page 26, Mr. Penny's assumption. Now, remember, his only assumption was the corporation converted to an S, and I'm therefore entitled to ignore federal taxes and only use the state and city rate of 11%. They say, Mr. Penny's assumptions regarding the appropriate tax rate was adopted by the court. Yeah, that's what happened. And that's the only explanation for what happened. So we say, Your Honor, that the best proof that the Chancery Court heard here and didn't follow the law, didn't follow the CNA case, was assume that this company going forward, it was going from flat income to five times the pre-merger income in the DCF projection period over the next 10 years, which is what both experts in the court were valuing. Even if somehow, although it's not explained by the court what the numbers were or how it was going to happen, even if this company were able to manage its taxable income down to $1, could it achieve an effective tax rate of 11% valued as a C corporation? The answer is no. The tax rates are in the code, they're set out in our brief. The lowest rate on the first dollar is 15%. That's just federal. The lowest state rate is 16%.
I'm a little bit confused. I thought that the court came to the conclusion that this company had a history of managing its income in such a fashion that it did not pay the full amount of taxes, as most people try to, most companies and people try to avoid paying any more taxes than they have to. And if you look at it from that perspective, the fact that this rate doesn't match even the lowest rate has nothing to do with it, because it's a question of how much taxes have they paid compared to their actual income, and if it comes out at a lower rate, then that's the rate the court chose. Why is that an inappropriate way of looking at it?
Can't get there from here, Your Honor, because what it paid in the only 3 years when it made any money over and above its fixed costs was 43% to 44%, paid it in 1988, paid it in 1999, paid it in 2000. It had an extraordinary bonus payment in that last year for an expense that reduced its taxable income, but its rate that it paid on the taxable income was over 40%. The court confused gross income. You never pay tax on gross income. You pay tax on net income. What it plugged in, contrary to what both experts agreed you couldn't do, it plugged in a rate against net income. This company never paid, even when it made very little or no money, it never paid 11% of its taxable income. Not 1 year. They don't cite 1 year when it did that. They conceded at oral argument when pressed by the court that in the 3 years preceding the merger, don't forget the court began its opinion by saying, you know, the early years are really not relevant here. What's relevant is the 3 years before the merger valuation date, because that's when things change. That's when you started to make a lot of money. And in those 3 years, the actual historical and legal tax rate that the company paid, not hypothetically, what it really paid and what it was required to pay, was over 40%.
Over 40% of taxable income.
That's right.
By definition, that's what you're going to pay, is the appropriate percentage of taxable income. But what about the actual income before you determine what the taxable income is?
Let me give you an example, but that's not what the court did, Your Honor. The court's initial opinion said, well, let's use 11% of gross income. We pointed out to the court in a motion for re-argument and clarification, because he was concerned that they paid a lower proportion historically when you look back 10 years, which he also said was really not relevant, but he said you had paid on average, you know, less than 10% of your gross income when all was said and done. So therefore, I don't really, I want to use 11% of gross income. We said, well, you can't do that without increasing the expenses, because what both experts tendered to the court and what he accepted was a ratio of expense to revenue in the future, that's what was being valued, which would yield 28% of gross revenue. If, depending on what tax rate, if you use the legal tax rate. Of course, you misunderstood me. I'm changing my opinion in four places to say, plug in 11% against net income. You can't do that. The CNA case says you can't do it. They haven't cited a single case that says you can do it. They haven't cited a finance treatise that says you can do it. Now, let me address the court's concern that it apparently had that led to this error. It said, well, in the past, you had a lower proportion of gross income. In fact, in 1997, looking at a debt-free model, which was in our brief, which is what the DCF does, we paid 22% of our gross income in income tax, in income taxes. So that wasn't unusual. But both experts agreed that was a natural consequence of two things: extraordinary increase in revenue and constant inflationary growth in expenses. That was a good thing for this plaintiff. It reminds me of the lazy man who says, why should I work harder? I'll be in a higher tax bracket, and I'll have to pay 50% of my new enlarged income for the government, so I'm not going to seek that promotion. And what he forgets is he's going to have another 50 cents in his pocket, and that additional 50 cents is what's discounted back and increases the value of this plaintiff's stock. And every stockholder stock. Let me give you a simple example, if I can, that's consistent with the facts of this case. Let's assume you have a C Corp. That's what was being valued here. It's got $1 million of revenue and $900,000 of net income of expense. It's got, therefore, 100,000 $44,000 of taxable income. It pays $44,000 in taxes using the 44% legal mandated rate, state, city, and federal. That means, as a percentage of gross revenue, it only paid 4.5%. Now, let's assume this happened here, that revenue goes from $1 million to $2.5 million, while expenses increase at 3% to $927,000. We now have net income that's going to be taxed of $1,573,000. We apply the legal tax rate. Both experts said that's what you do. They don't have any contrary finance theory or case that says we'd ever do anything differently. The company will pay taxes of $700,000 or 28% of gross revenues. But like my example of the lazy man who didn't want to work harder because he got to pay more taxes, the shareholders have $863,000 more in their pocket. That's what gets discounted back. That's what drives up the value of the stock. It makes no sense, and plaintiff could never explain why it would be a good idea to increase expenses and drive down your taxable income. It costs you a dollar of expense to save 44.5 cents. The way our expert did it is the right way. It's the legal way. It's supported by the record. The court will find no support for an 11% rate. The only justification that the appellee has offered is in its brief when it said, yeah, the court accepted our expert's 11% rate. Can't do it. It's internally inconsistent. Let me turn just for a moment to the Pascal case. The Pascal case didn't say you can be a little bit pregnant. This court said you can't use a theoretical liquidating value if the company's assets are not for sale. The operative reality was our assets were not for sale. We're going to hold on to the building forever. The Landau report says at page 10, that's what plaintiff copied, relied on, stapled, and said this is a net asset value. That our report assumes a sale of the building on day one, i.e. the merger date. That's a theoretical liquidating value. That's precluded. This isn't Kirby Lumber where company has appreciating assets and no earnings, and the court says, well, let's look at the fair value of the appreciation of the assets. This was like Pascal. This was a presumed sale of the parking garage here, the building, on day one. That's what they report they relied on. It's precluded. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm pleased to court Steve Capone for the plaintiff below, appellee. I'll address the tax issue first. I think we'll begin by noting one fundamental difference that we have with the appellant's recitation. We do not believe it's an issue of law that is being reviewed de novo by this court. We believe the application of the 11% tax rate is an issue of fact that was made by the lower court in looking at the totality of the circumstances and this company's history of, as the court noted, manipulating its tax liability by adjusting officer compensation. While in theory, as pointed out by counsel, it's not always in the company's best interest to manipulate officer compensation, it is when those officers are the controlling stockholders. Essentially, what we have here was a shifting of what would have been profit to the controlling stockholders in the form of compensation, which was essentially a disguised dividend.
Well, what is your response to the contention that the company never paid 11%? Effectively, I think that was the argument that the appellant just made.
There's two facets to that argument. One, if you look at the bottom line tax rate that was applied to net operating income, it is correct. The net operating income is always taxed at the appropriate C corporation tax rate. That's because that's the rate you must plug in on your form. As a percentage of gross revenue, it is also correct to never pay 11%. Historically, as noted by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, in the preceding 9 years, the company paid on average 5.6% of its gross revenue in taxes. The 11% tax rate was adopted by the court in order to approximate what would to keep the taxes going forward in that bracket. The tax rate advocated by...
So it was an average of something?
The 11% was reached by the court looking at the historical manipulation of taxes and looking at the history of paying somewhere between 1%, at 1 year they paid 18%, and the court determined that 11% would approximate the percentage of gross revenue the company would anticipated the company would pay in taxes going forward during the discounted cash flow period, and it brought it back. So, yes, the 11% was not paid on net operating income, but it reflected the percentage of gross revenue that was actually taxed or paid in taxes by the company in the preceding 9 years. I think counsel noted that there's no support in the record for how the 11% number was derived, and I would respectfully submit that's just flatly incorrect. Below, at trial, post-trial briefing, and again, the briefing before this court, we laid out in detail the financial history of the company, which showed that every year in which income increased, officer compensation increased in proportion to keep taxes, the percentage of gross revenue paid in taxes, very low. It was also stated that the company was essentially having flat earnings in the years prior to the merger. That was also incorrect. On page 15 of our brief before this court, there's a chart which indicates that in the 3 years prior to the merger, income went from approximately $1.2 million to $2.7 million. In that same period, officer compensation tripled from slightly below $300,000 to slightly below $1 million. Again, this was compensation paid only to the controlling stockholders, of which they represented essentially four of the five stockholders, my client being the one stockholder who did not receive any compensation. So the support for the 11% tax rate, the support for the manipulation of the tax liability was not simply the adoption of Mr. Penny's conclusions. It was a conclusion reached by the court based on the facts presented, and that was taken from the company's tax records, its accounting statements, its outside audit report, which showed how the compensation fluctuated. Furthermore, the record reflected that there was no additional obligations taken on by the officers and the controlling stockholders to warrant a tripling, more than tripling, of officer compensation in the same period. It was a five-story building. All five stories were rented to tenants. There was no increase in obligations or demands on the officers. Just simply the rent they were able to achieve as a result of the increase in the property values in Soho went up, but there were no further demands on maintaining the property. We believe the Vice Chancellor correctly rejected the black line application of a 44% tax rate, because in essence, if you're setting a new obligation on the Court of Trade that all future proceedings under Section 262, they must ignore the totality of the circumstances and blindly apply a tax rate. And we think that cuts against the grain of this Court's jurisprudence of the last number of years, which is to afford the Court of Chancery increased flexibility in valuing corporations in an appraisal proceeding. I think it was probably most notably evident from the Court's decision to move away from a rigid application of the Delaware block method and to allow the court to adopt any well-recognized methodology for valuing corporations.
Can I stop you at that point? If I understand your opponent's argument correctly, what they're saying is that there was no valuation methodology that would explain the 11%. Both experts were saying, no, you know, there's an S corporation rate, there's a C corporation rate, and this is kind of whole cloth coming from nowhere in terms of having some reasoned basis. I think I understand that you're saying the court said, well, this company always minimized its tax obligations, so 11% was a good number, but doesn't the court have to follow some accepted approach to this as opposed to just picking numbers?
It does, and we believe it did, and for the following reasons. The approach taken by the plaintiff below was not, this is an S corporation, here's the only basis for an 11% tax rate. The approach below was primarily it should be valued as an S corporation with an 11% tax rate. Should the court not accept that based as a matter of law that should be valued as an S corporation? If you look historically at the company's performance, 11% is an appropriate tax rate because it reflects the operative reality of the company at the time of the merger.
Okay, but I thought your expert did not agree with that.
That was our position. It was our position in the post-trial briefing. In conducting his discounted cash flow analysis, the primary reason was we argued it should be valued as an S corporation. But
did your expert say if you don't want to value this as an S corporation, you should still go with 11%?
In his report, yes, Your Honor. The report, the focus again was primarily on S, but it was given the company's performance, its practice, look at the totality of the circumstances. 11% is appropriate, primarily because it's an S. But that conclusion is bolstered by the fact that it's consistent with the company's historical practices. As I think is noted by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, where he found, again, that the taxes were always relatively minor and salaries were adjusted to keep it that way. And this was not something plucked from whole cloth or an argument that was raised here. This was briefed extensively below and is why the court was able to include in its opinion all the various dollar figures and tax assumptions and percentages regarding taxes because they were all presented to the court on the record below.
I'm not sure I followed your answer to Justice Berger's question. You began with the focus was on Subchapter S Corporation in your expert's report. And I thought the question was, if it were as a C Corporation, would your expert have come to the same conclusion that 11% was an appropriate figure?
Yes. That was our position. The reason why, if you look...
Was that the position that your expert took in the report?
I thought
was the question.
Our expert never took the position that this company should be taxed at a rate of 44.7%, which is the C tax rate. Always took the position it should be taxed at 11%, which took into consideration the excess compensation paid to the controlling stockholders.
So it wasn't critical to your expert's ultimate conclusion that it was or was not a Subchapter S corporation?
It was not critical. It was clearly the primary focus in our number one argument, but the court did not rise or fall on that position. And I think it's further evidenced by the following fact. The conclusion reached by the court on the tax rate, the court was not asked to opine on the tax rate. It was asked to value the entity. The critical conclusion reached by the court was that the actual taxes paid as percentage of gross revenue had been manipulated as a result of officer compensation. That fact has to be taken into consideration in some fashion. And that was, again, I think a finding of fact by the court alone, which is not being challenged and is not clearly erroneous. The question is, how do you take into consideration the fact that salaries were inflated in order to minimize the tax liability? The most direct approach to achieving that result is the one that we advocated below, which was if you apply a 11% tax rate on net operating income, it will approximate what the company had historically paid taxes as a percentage of gross revenue. There were alternative methods the court could have used to achieve the same result. They would have been far more complicated. An example would have been to have the salaries increase and fluctuate in proportion to the increase and fluctuations in income, then determine what percentage of that fluctuation was not attributable to actually earned income, but was attributable to the tax manipulation, and then apportion part of that back to the plaintiff in valuing the company. That would have been a far more complicated, messy task, and would have been a task that would have been undertaken after the court had issued its decision. The more straightforward and clear way to go about it was to use a 11% tax rate, which, again, we argue is a factual determination in the discounted cash flow, no different than the factual determination as to what the appropriate expenses were, salaries, interest income, et cetera, that would have been present. One other point I'd like to raise, I think the appellants seeking to quibble with the 44% tax rate do not take into consideration the court's factual finding regarding the manipulation of the salaries and the tax rates. They simply want to change one line item and what the court noted was a comprehensive valuation approach and not take into consideration the ripple effect that has throughout the rest of the discounted cash flow analysis and the adjusted net asset value analysis. If you just change that tax number back to 44%, it drives down, theoretically, the value of this company by approximately $10 million, and my client's proportionate interest by around $3 million. all under the guise that those funds will be paid to a taxing authority. The record reflects that we, as a matter of fact, that those funds were never paid to a taxing authority and would never be paid to a taxing authority. So if you just make the adjustment and you don't account for anything else, you create a fiction which strips the plaintiff of a substantial portion of his interest in this company, a fact which is not addressed in the briefing of the appellants or in their argument here today, or for that matter, as it did before the lower court. You have to take it into consideration and give effect to the finding that the salaries were manipulated. And it was also mentioned that has not been a single case cited by the plaintiff and the appellee which states that you can use a tax rate other than 44.7%. I would submit that the burden is on the appellant to show a case which says that is absolutely a requirement. They themselves have not found a case, despite their diligent efforts, in this state or any other state which says when valuing a company in an appraisal proceeding or in a similar context, you have to have a black letter application of a specific tax rate simply because that's what the IRS dictates. And I would submit that to that requirement in and of itself would lend itself to abuse, as would be, I think, referenced in this case. Because what would be required or what would be occur is a company looking to disenfranchise a minority shareholder would simply move some of its operations into a state with a higher tax rate. A tax rate which they're never going to pay. They then consummate a merger and come in and say, well, California taxes it at 25%. Now instead of driving the price down of the company by $10 million, we're going to drive it down by $15 million. All the while knowing that money is never going to go to the taxing authority, it's going to go into the controlling stockholder's pocket. So I think the approach advocated by the other side lends itself to abuse and is inconsistent with the findings of Vice Chancellor Jacobs. Unless the court had any other questions on the tax issue, I was going to move on to the issue regarding the Pascal decision.
As you do, I should point out to you, Justice Berger noted that I was so engrossed in the argument I forgot to set the clock. So regardless of what the clock says in front of you, when you reach 7 minutes, you have 2 minutes left.
Thank you. I think I decided to move on. With respect to the tax, the issue of the Pascal decision, I think we have a wolf in sheep's clothing here. The other side is coming for this court under the guise of enforcing the Pascal decision, taking the position that Pascal prohibits any use of a liquidation value. And I would submit that they're not seeking to enforce the Pascal decision, they're seeking to overturn the Pascal decision. Pascal clearly states that the adjustment that a theoretical liquidation value cannot be the sole basis for valuing a company in an appraisal proceeding. Sole, one does not need a dictionary to know, means only, the only method. This court took great pains in its decision to italicize the word sole throughout its opinion to indicate that it could be used in conjunction with other methods, it could not be the sole method. So I think what we have is not a situation where an expert or the court below relied solely on liquidation method. It applied multiple methodologies. The appellants are advocating a rule by this court that states any use of a theoretical liquidation value, no matter how minor, is per se legal error and is reversible error. That flies in the face of Pascal, and I don't think the record below or record for this court warrants an extension of Pascal to prohibit any use of theoretical liquidation value. Furthermore, as a matter of fact, which I think is well supported by the record, the court below found that the approach proffered by the plaintiff and ultimately adopted by the court was not a liquidation value, that it did not take into consideration any of the factors that one anticipates to see in a liquidation value. It did not take into consideration capital gains taxes or liquidation expenses. What it did was have a different approach from discounted cash flow analysis, which took into consideration the value of this building from the standpoint from a real estate context versus a simple income context. Now, it is somewhat surprising that the other side takes such great pains to shoot down this theory when the approach taken by the first expert they retained to value this entity, which was the Landauer Realty Company. The court below found that the Landauer report itself was not a liquidation value. It found that Mr. Penny's partial adoption of that report and modification of the report, unlike the characterization that he simply stapled the report, attached the signature page, and submitted it, is incorrect. The court below noted, as a matter of fact, Mr. Penny made substantial changes to the Landauer report, taking into consideration corporate level expenses, and that change in the underlying report, neither of which were a liquidation value. We do know what a liquidation value looks like in the context of this proceeding because the defendant's second expert, Empire, did adopt a liquidation value. It did what Mr. Penny did not do. It took the Landauer report, the first expert, contemplated a sale, deducted capital gains taxes, deducted transfer taxes, and deducted liquidation expenses. That was the basis, that was the value that was used when determining the compensation to be paid to the plaintiff as a result of the merger. 2 years into the litigation, it was pointed out that that opinion clearly violated the tenets of Paschal. The defendants put Empire aside and went out and retained Mr. Grabowski as their third expert. So I'm sorry, if you take Mr. Penny's report and you look at the Empire report, you clearly see the difference between a report that passes muster under Paschal and one that does not. I think it aptly supports the Vice Chancellor's conclusions that this was not a liquidation value. The only other argument put forth with respect to Paschal, or the adjusted net asset value by the other side, is to suggest that the lower court failed to take into consideration certain adjustments to the net asset value. I think as argued in the opinion below, those arguments were never raised during the trial. They were not raised after the opinion was issued in the form of post-trial argument, which the court on two separate occasions noted that the arguments had never been presented. I should say first, the Vice Chancellor noted the arguments had not been presented at trial and were procedurally barred. The defendants took a second bite of the apple and said, no, we really did present them, and here's our best case for why we presented them to you. And the Vice Chancellor said, essentially, I was awake at the trial, I know what you told me, and you didn't raise these arguments squarely before me, and you're not going to do it in the context of post-trial argument, which would require the creation of a new evidentiary record and essentially the reopening of the case, because there was not sufficient facts on the record on which defendants can make their case. What they can do is point to something they say, we think it's wrong, but they're unable to do is come forward with any facts, analysis, expert opinion, alternative methodology which demonstrates why it's wrong and comes to an ultimate conclusion. I see my time's almost up, so unless there's any questions, I'll take my seat.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the question that Justice Berger and Your Honor put to Mr. Capone. Did their expert's report also consider using an 11% rate if this was valued as a city? Mr. Capone said it did. The court will examine that report. It's not in there. More importantly, the court has, as part of the record, the transcript of the oral argument before then Vice Chancellor Jacobs. At page 76 of that transcript, Vice Chancellor Jacobs pressed Mr. Capone. He asked the same question, and I'm quoting, did Mr. Penny do a separate analysis based on an S assumption and one without? Mr. Capone said no, it's not in the report. At the end of the oral, later in the oral argument, this is at page 79, Vice Chancellor Jacobs was very clear with Mr. Capone. He said, if there is a place in Mr. Penny's report where he values this company without making the subchapter S assumption, tell me. What did Mr. Capone respond? Not what he told Your Honors today. He said, I can't think of any offhand. I will review the testimony and the report and supply the court with any citations after the argument. He never did. Why didn't he? It's not in the testimony of Mr. Penny. You will find it nowhere. In fact, he said, at several places, and we cite them in our brief, including at page 141 of the trial transcript, if I didn't make the S assumption, I would have, and valued this as a city, I would have used 44%.
Didn't the Vice Chancellor effectively, well, I used the word effectively, determine the effective tax rate of 11%? Is there a basis to do that? And my first question. And my second question is, what is your contention as to the effective tax rate?
The effective tax rate is what the company paid historically, which was what the court was trying to get to. The effective tax rate was more than 40%, was as high as 46%, and never lower than 40%. The court does not tell you, even if you assume, going back 10 years, that it paid five, because it had high expenses and low revenues, that it paid 5.6% on average of gross revenues, the court doesn't explain how you get from there, nor does the appellee. It's not in the brief, it's not in the opinion, how you get from that to an effective rate of 11% of net income. You can't get there. There's no logical process to get there. One doesn't relate to the number. It's pulled.
Well, where are these numbers, 1 to 18% that your opponent cited? Did you hear him say that? 1 to 18%.
Yes.
Is that in the record?
That is, a gross percentage of gross revenue. What he conceded here today, what he conceded at trial, was historically the company paid an effective tax rate on its net income of more than 40%. Never paid 11%, couldn't pay 11% because on the first dollar, just as a matter of federal tax law, you're going to pay 15%. Now, you heard a lot of...
Your time is over, actually, but I didn't manipulate the clock as well as the Vice Chancellor manipulated the gross and net income percentages.
Yeah.
I apologize. If you finished answering Justice Ridgie's question, fine.
I have.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I hope you will allow me to greet Mr. Merkins, my former clerk, who I see has been silent during the argument. At least he's here. Nice to see you, Mr. Merkins.
Please rise.